there. It's another Tuesday. It's Susan King, where genealogy and spirit connect. We're here for another wonderful session with a really interesting guest, Arthur Kurzweil, probably one of the biggest mentors I have had in my study of Jewish genealogy and spirituality. So what I'm doing really is not new. I think Arthur, as we'll see, is probably the initiator of some of this. So anyway, we really want to welcome everybody. It's going to be a good session. I want to give out our toll-free number. We will be taking calls. That number is 888-815-9756, and that is a worldwide number. As I mentioned, my guest today is Arthur Kurzweil, and he's probably best known for his books on genealogy from generation to generation, How to Trace Your Jewish Genealogy and Family History. And he's also written a few books for dummies, and probably need a few of those myself, The Kabbalah for Dummies and The Torah for Dummies. Arthur is probably in the Jewish world, one of the most renowned American authors, educators, editors, writers, and publishers. And when I got his bio, I also found out he was a magician. So we've got a musician and a magician today, and I think that'll be kind of a fun afternoon. Arthur grew up in East Meadow, New York, and he earned his Bachelor of Arts degree from New College of Hofstra University, 1971, and a Master of Library Science from Florida State University. He has been involved for these many years. He's published probably over 650 volumes of books of Jewish interest, which is a pretty substantial contribution to contemporary English language Jewish library. Arthur, welcome. This is kind of a neat experience for me. I think your book was one of the first books that I picked up when I got interested in genealogy. I think it was back in 1986, and I probably have one of your earliest versions, because I just looked at the copyright date, and it says 1982. So I'm sure you've had a lot of updating to do on that particular book from generation to generation. But one of the things that I think caught my eye then and still catches my eye as far as what genealogy really is, and you really bring it up, I think, in the first chapter about going back to the Early Testament and the Bible, and how the whole history of our people was written in genealogy style. So anyway, let's talk about that a little bit. I think that I've kind of become interested in the whole spiritual movement, and I think that when we look at the Kabbalah, it probably was one of the earliest spiritual movements. So can you give us a little definition or background on the Kabbalah and how you see it as it relates to genealogy?
Well, thank you for the question. It's such an important question for me personally. Kabbalah is the theology of the Jewish people. It's not the customs, and it's not the history, and it's not the laws and all the do's and don'ts. Kabbalah is that aspect of Jewish tradition which deals with the big questions of life. Who am I? Where did I come from? Where am I going? What is this life all about? Why is there so much suffering in the world? How do I find meaning in my existence? What is the nature of the soul? Does the soul exist before the body? What happens after death? These kinds of spiritual questions are the questions that Kabbalah deals with. Again, not the do's and don'ts and not the rich history and all the customs and holidays that so many of us know about. The theological aspect, the abstract ideas that hold up the whole thing of Judaism, that's what Kabbalah is about. And if I could say simply put, that my connection between my interest in spiritual things and my interest in genealogy my awareness was not present at the beginning. I was fooling myself and fooling the world into thinking that what I was doing in genealogy was historical research. And that's how I answered the questions of people, and that's kind of how I framed it for myself. It took a while for me to realize that it wasn't merely historical research that I was involved with, that really it was a search for myself, a search for a participation in the enterprise of asking these questions. Who am I? Where did I come from? Where am I going? What is this life all about? One of the delightful things that Jews find out when they're on this path is that if they are plagued with these questions, if they're plagued, if you wake up in the morning and you think, who am I? Where did I come from? Where am I going? What is this life all about? It's nice to know that we come from a long, long line of great individuals who have also been obsessed with these questions.
And two, when you look at, I guess, the growth in two major industries over the last, I guess, 10 years, I would say, with the growth of genealogy and the growth of the spiritual industries, I mean, they've gone both pretty much in tandem, as I see it, that there's a real interest and a real need in learning about this. And while the Kabbalah, is built, they say Jewish mysticism, and I want to question that, because I don't see it as a mysticism. I mean, I see it more as a spirituality. But I think this is something that's being addressed not only in the Jewish cultures, but in cultures worldwide, which I think is maybe one of the reasons these two industries are spiraling in tandem, in my opinion. There are a lot of people, and I mean, I'm sure you can reference this, but, a lot of modern-day people who are not Jews or have been publicly known to be following the Kabbalah. I think Madonna's one, and I actually think that Michael Jackson was one. So the Kabbalah really isn't totally focused for Jewish participation, is it?
Well, Madonna or Michael Jackson or anybody else for that matter has the every right to look wherever they want to look for wisdom. Wisdom is wisdom. In the Talmud it says, who's wise? He who learns from everyone. So Michael Jackson, Madonna certainly have just as much of a right, maybe even more of a need to ask questions about the meaning of existence than any of us do. So they have a right to look towards Jewish tradition to see what it is that Kabbalah offers. You can't divorce Kabbalah from Jewish tradition. Every great Kabbalist in the history of Kabbalah was an observant religious Jew. And their practice, their spiritual practice, their ritual practice, their prayers and their study were part and parcel of their Kabbalistic lifestyle. It doesn't mean that everybody who reaps any nourishment from Kabbalah has to follow in that path any more than when one goes to a spiritual bookstore and buys a book on Buddhism. You can open that book and see what the Dalai Lama says, and wisdom is wisdom. If it's something that clicks and something that's nourishing, you don't have to be a Buddhist to be nourished by the Dalai Lama any more than you need to be a Orthodox Jew to be nourished by Kabbalah. But to represent Kabbalah as something disconnected from Judaism, I would say it would be an inaccurate way of putting it.
Right, but it is something that people who are perhaps not, Jews have attached themselves to, probably because of some of the teachings and the spiritual teachings that are in there.
One of the basic teachings of Kabbalah has to do with the relationship between the right hand and the left hand. Something as simple as the relationship between the right and left hand. There's tremendous Kabbalistic literature that has to do with the relationship between right and left. Now, everybody has a right and left, not just Jews. So if Kabbalistic tradition is saying that there's something important to understand and to get good at regarding one's relationship between the right hand and the left hand, that if that's important, that's important to everybody, not just the Jews.
Absolutely. So, getting into the whole relationship of spirituality and you know, we can maybe take it at that level. And genealogy. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that I think you mentioned early in the book in 1982, the copy that I have, is how important genealogy and the understanding of where we come from and where we came from, how important that is to really the study of self, which is something that I've garnered from it over the last 20-some-odd years that I've been involved in it. And do you have any real wisdom on why you see that as something that, you know, either, you know, some people get involved in the spirituality of genealogy and see it as that, and some people don't, or maybe they don't admit it. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that I think you just hit the nail on the head in terms of not admitting it. You know, Ram Dass used to say, maybe he still says it, that there we all know people in the world who we would call phony holy. There are a lot of phony holies around. Well,
right.
There are also people who are phony unholy. You know, or, right?
Yeah.
People who don't realize that the genealogy, their obsession with genealogy, this undertaking that occupies their minds 24 hours a day, and the more they find, the more they have to find, and once they, and they're up till 3 in the morning, and then and day after day, and month after month, and it becomes an obsession. You know, there's a spiritual aspect to that that they may not be, people are not always so aware of, but it's a hunger and a thirst for connection, you know, it's a need for the soul to return to God. It's a need to find one's place. There's a beautiful image in Kabbalah that says that everybody is a letter in the Torah and has to find its place. That your letter is different from my letter, but we each have to find which is our letter in the Torah, is the image that's used. I think genealogy is a way of helping to navigate that. You know, Rabbi Steinsaltz, the great Talmud scholar, Rabbi Steinsaltz of Jerusalem, he wrote a book called Tshuva, which is the Hebrew word for the inner turning that we do when we contemplate what's going on within us. So he has a book called Tshuva. Well, in that book, Tshuva, there's a whole chapter, and this is again an Orthodox rabbi writing, a whole chapter on genealogy as an important spiritual tool. You know, when one reflects on these things, it's not just names, as you know, I'm not telling you, it's not just names and dates, but the outsider, the one who hasn't tasted genealogy, doesn't realize, they look from the outside and they think that genealogy is names and dates on a piece of paper like a family tree, and don't realize that the whole process of genealogy is one of, first of all, it's one of listening. You know, we
yes.
Genealogists, what do we have to do? We have to find relatives, and we have to sit at their feet and listen to them.
Yes.
Which is really the posture of the pilgrim, who has to look for, who's looking for somebody who has nourishment, and you empty yourself in order to receive. You know, the very word Kabbalah means to receive. So you know, the one of the great compliments that you can give in Jewish life in the yeshiva is to call somebody a Talmud Chacham. This Hebrew expression, Talmud Chacham, means a student of the wise. The greatest compliment that you can give to somebody is to say that you're a student of the wise. And this is what the genealogist does. He or she goes from person to person, emptying and listening and receiving and finding that. It's really the way of a pilgrimage and that connection to people. You know, in the Jewish world, I know this is true for me as somebody who comes from a Jewish family, that a generation and a half ago, one of every three Jews in the world was murdered. You know, a third of the Jewish people were murdered. So, you know, we who come after that, we are a rebuilding generation who are trying to somehow put the pieces back together. We're a traumatized, shattered people who are cut off from our sources and cut off from our brothers and sisters never saw each other again. Husbands and wives never saw each other again. So as a rebuilding people, we're the genealogy is an important tool in that regard.
And, you know, and we see this too in not only genealogy, but African American genealogy, which was, very, very pertinent, I guess, in recent weeks with President Obama's visit to Africa.
Yes.
There have been disconnects, I guess, in religions and ethnicities over all these many, many, many years. And really what genealogy does is help us connect and rebond with not only our people, but, possibly connecting and rebonding with the people of the world, so to speak. It seems to me, and then, I have some statements on like this on my website, and maybe I'm just it escapes me. But, I try to want to look to the good in everything and to the positive in everything. And, if more and more people were involved in their hunt for self or study of self, and if genealogy was a modality that could be used for that, would you not think, Arthur, that we might have a little bit more understanding and tolerance amongst people of the world?
I surely do. I think I've said it among people who I've had an opportunity to talk to about genealogy 1,000 times over the years, that what genealogy does is it teaches tolerance, because you, at a certain point, you realize that it's just one big tree. There's a beautiful statement in the Talmud about it. It said, it's asked, why did God make Adam? Why didn't God make a lot of different people all over the place? Why did he start with just one person?
Mm-hmm.
And the rabbis in the Talmud say the answer is so that nobody could say my ancestors are greater than yours. Because it's one family. And at a certain point, when you trace your family tree, it never is explicit, but somehow it gets into you and changes who you are and changes how you see the world, because in a certain way, everybody becomes your cousin.
Right. And, I think with all this new social networking and things going on, and have been going on, I think, my involvement was in the very early days of what's just, hit the Internet over the last couple of years. But, there are so many ways to connect today and connect with other people and connect with in genealogy. It's just mind-boggling. And they pop up every day, new sites, and they're all, very, very good, and they all have, particular specialties or areas of where they want to focus. And it just seems to me, at as I see the growth of genealogy over the last 10 years, really, that people are starting to come together. I get a little unnerved sometimes when I still hear, people having major separations between, family members. And, I one day I hope that working on genealogy might even help those families do some healing as far as better understanding each other. I think that there are many tools out there, and I think that genealogy is one of the biggest ones, and that's my take on the subject.
You mentioned this book that I wrote, From Generation to Generation, actually.
Yes.
Was originally published in 1980. And in that original edition, I reprinted at the end of the book an essay written by a psychiatrist. The essay was all about the wisdom of attending family reunions. And from a psychological point of view, what happens when you attend personally, in an inner way, what happens to you when you attend a family reunion? I know that in my own family, in the Kurzweil side of the family, I've organized and held any number of Hanukkah parties over the years where a couple of hundred people, all of whom are related to each other, are in the same room celebrating together. And one day, one of the people in my family, a psychologist actually, she came over to me and she said to me, "Arthur, thank you for changing the constellation of the family."
Ah.
And I so much appreciated the metaphor that she used to change the constellation, you know, of the family. There were branches of the family who were now knowing each other and seeing each other and inviting each other to family occasions, and there was two branches of the family who were not on speaking terms and didn't even know why they weren't on speaking terms anymore. But so when you say a healing can go on, there's no question about it. Again, I don't want to belabor the point, but so many people think that genealogy is names and dates,
and
it just isn't.
No, and in some deep way, when you look at the millions and millions and millions of people who are embarking on their genealogy journey, I call it a spiritual journey, you know, I like to ask them sometimes, you know, why are you doing this? I mean, you know, why is it important to you? And, you know, I think sometimes some people do have a hard time explaining that even to themselves. And, you know, I noticed it, I guess it just kind of hit me right away, is when I first started, you know, doing research, and I guess we're going back to the mid-80s, and there were situations that came up that you know, stories that were in the family that I started finding out that weren't true, and I started realizing the effects that some of these untruths started having on the children of those generations who then grew up to be my grandmother. And you know, how devastating that is. And, you know, I mean, some of these things now are, you can't hide from. I mean, you know, the truth will come out now with the social networking. It's kind of, you know, if you have something to hide, don't get involved. That's the way it looks to me. But in one respect, it's really very positive because, you know, all of us are here. All of us are born. All of us walk a journey through life, and all of us, you know, die at some point, and we all do it in the best way that we can. We obviously have some roadblocks and stumbles along the road, and we eventually all end up in the same place, so to speak. You know, when a family is separated, or if a family is separated, do you have any advice that you would give them on maybe some tools through either, you know, through both genealogy and maybe the wisdom of the Kabbalah on, you know, some things that they might be able to do to begin that healing process?
So let me ask you a question. Let me answer
sure.
this with a question. What do you mean when a family is separated?
Well, their families don't talk to each other. You know, that they don't talk to each other. They just, there was a falling out, and like you said, generations ago, some even in current generations, where you have a schism between family members. You know, some over inheritance. I see that a lot. Some over somebody doing something that the other party didn't like what they did. So there are multiple reasons why, you know, family members would end up on opposite ends of the fences and not want to speak to each other.
Well, you know, I guess the impish part of me is wondering that sometimes it's good not to speak to somebody.
Well, that's true.
You know,
that's true.
There's an interesting book of Kabbalah that has 10 chapters. Each chapter has a very important message, essential Kabbalistic message. So one chapter is about the idea that, according to Kabbalistic tradition, there's nothing in the world that's good or bad, by definition. In other words, love is not always good and hate is not always bad. Sometimes love is not what the situation calls for. Sometimes it's not always good to be honest. You know, you walk into a hospital room and the patient looks worse than yesterday. You don't say, you know, you look worse than yesterday.
True. No,
sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. But so honesty as a value is not always good or not always bad. The Kabbalists teach that everything is based on what the pharmacist knows, which is that there's a fine line between a poison and a medicine. And it has to do with timing and with the dosage. Sometimes hate is exactly what the situation calls for, that there are certain things that are appropriate or inappropriate, not based on something intrinsic to them, but based on how they're used. This is one of the messages that Kabbalah has taught over and over and over again, that the reason that we study and study and study and study all these cases is so that we can exercise our ability to live and make judgments constantly. People often have, for example, a misunderstanding about what it is to be an Orthodox Jew. My family, we are a pretty traditional Jewish family, and my daughter is a Jewish educator, and one day a girl came up to her and said, a teenage girl said, you religious Jews have it so easy. All you have to do is look in the book and see what to do and see what not to do, and you follow it and everything's fine. And my daughter said, no, you misunderstand. You have it slightly wrong. What we do is we study, and then when we close the books and we go out into the world, we're on our own. We have to decide what's right and what's wrong based on the particular moment, the particular incident, and all of the details of that particular incident. You know, the only legitimate answer to the question, what is the Jewish view of abortion? There's only one answer that's appropriate, that's acceptable. What is the Jewish view of abortion? And the answer is, tell me the case. Tell me what the situation is with that particular woman and that particular situation, and then we'll do our best, considering all the details, to make a judgment. So going back to the family, sometimes there's good reason why two people are not talking to each other. You know, so I wouldn't want to jump to the conclusion that if you're not talking to another member of the family, that's by definition bad. You know, sometimes you have to separate in order for there to be a healing. I was just talking to a friend yesterday about an old book that we both read in the 60s. The title of the book was so beautiful. The title of the book was "Don't Push the River; It Flows by Itself."
Oh wow!
Such a beautiful statement.
It is.
Don't push the river; it flows by itself. That sometimes, everything has a gestation period.
Yes.
Sometimes two people who are fighting, who are not talking to each other, need a cooling off period before they come back together. Others, what they just need is a little bit of a push or a little bit of help from somebody because they're a little bit bashful and they can't do it themselves. You know, so those of us who are involved with our families and those of us who are involved with genealogy, I think have often become those people to a certain extent in our families. You know, I became known in my family as the genealogy nut, but the genealogy nut also transferred into the person who can make connections, so that when this branch of the family wants to know that branch of the family, I can get them together. I can start the family reunion. I can invite them both over to my home. I can do some of that bridge building. So I think each of us who are genealogists have an opportunity to really participate in a healing way in the dynamics of our families.
That was beautifully stated. And I think we do have roles as genealogists to do more than just, put some names, dates, and places on paper.
One of the things I've said to people so often about one of the sins of the genealogist. One
yes.
of the sins of the genealogist is the genealogist who rips off his family. by writing letters, doing interviews, gathering information, and then never getting back to anybody.
Yep.
Making those connections with people and then keeping them alive, making the phone call, sending the card, inviting the person, making a phone call every once in a while. You know, you don't just track down an old relative, interview her for an hour and a half, and then never hear from her again, or never let her never hear from you again. It's that, you know, I've said for so many years that my best friends are 85 years old. You know, my best friends are the people in my family and the people in my neighborhood who have helped me to translate letters from Polish and from Hungarian when I was doing the genealogical research in Hungary and Poland. And you know, I need those elderly people, and they need me to need them. And somehow we have a nice little conspiracy going with each other that, again, is like you were saying before, making connections and building bridges between people. Genealogy is such an extraordinary way to bring generations together. I do a lot of Hebrew school programs, and when the principal of the Hebrew school calls me up and says, would you do a genealogy program for my Hebrew school, my answer is always the same. I say to them, when you have me speak to the kids, invite the parents also.
Right.
Because if I can talk to the kids, I'm sure I can talk to kids about genealogy and excite them. I'm sure I can talk to grown-ups, adults, about genealogy and excite them. If I can do that with parents and their children at the same time so they walk out of the room talking to each other about the family history, that's a good program.
That's an outstanding program. And my question would be, is why is this not being done more, not only in the Jewish world, but in all the worlds, you know, of bringing families together for the, you know, I mean, look at the amount of... That was the other thing that I guess when I got started, and excuse my jumping around here, but when I first got started in genealogy, I started realizing all these subjects that I just did not pay any attention to when I was in school. History, you know, political science, I mean, all sociology. I mean, at some time in my life, up until the age of 30-something, I had absolutely no interest in it. Right. And then suddenly, the minute I got involved in genealogy, I mean, that first tombstone that I looked at, you know, all of a sudden the atlases started to come out. And, man, what a eye-opener.
You know, I couldn't agree with you more once again. It doesn't surprise me, of course, but I remember when this book came out in 1980, I have to proudly say that I got lots of good reviews. But I got one negative review that I'll never forget. The author of the review, who is a well-known person, wrote this review and said that the problem with genealogy is that it's so egocentric. And I remember reading it and thinking to myself, that's not the problem with genealogy. That's the power of genealogy. When you teach a young person genealogy, you get a young person involved with tracing his or her family tree. Young people, they think that they are the center of the world to begin with. So, you know, if a young person thinks that they're the center of the world, great. Let's put them there. You're right in the center. Let's see, how'd you get there? You had two parents and four grandparents and eight great-grandparents and 16 great-great-grandparents and others, and they made decisions, and those decisions had an impact on you. And when you, as an educator, put the young person in the center, and you show the young person how they are connected to history, not disconnected. Suddenly these subjects that were so boring and so deadly and we were so disinterested in, I was exactly the same way. I hated history. The one class in college that I got an F, I got one F in college, it was a history class. You know, here I am talking all the time to groups about history and doing history genealogy research and teaching and making history come alive. But we have to encourage people to do this more. Otherwise, you know, I was telling somebody the other day that perhaps you know about Hansen's Law.
Right.
Hansen, you know, the historian Hansen, and Hansen's Law is the, you know, the children of immigrants want to forget, the grandchildren of immigrants want to remember. You know, and I think it's certainly true in Jewish families. I'm sure it's true in other immigrant families also, Italian families, Irish families, that those of us who have grandparents and great-grandparents who came to this country, you know, their children, our parents, I can talk for myself, my parents and my grandparents, when they came here, were pretty busy becoming American. They weren't busy preoccupying themselves with what went on before. They were busy with trying to figure out how to live today and tomorrow.
Right.
So, you know, once we grandchildren and great-grandchildren show up, as Hansen's law says, well, the children want to forget. We want to remember. We want to reconnect with. And we have the luxury, in a way, of not having to confront the challenges of our immigrant ancestors and then to do that reconnection and that spiritual search.
And, you know, and it is so important. And, I mean, my guest last week was Peg Zitko from the Ellis Island Foundation. And we actually spoke about some of the things that they're getting ready to do because, you know, it's a whole new wave of generations coming in now that they, you know, have gotten that, you know, that first database online and have it available. That, you know, we're now moving generationally away from this immigrant and, you know, the projects that they're putting in place to try to encourage exactly what it is that you're saying is, you know, making sure that the future generations understand and can have the sense of empath and whatever about what happened before, even though it's so many generations removed.
There's an irony and a kind of a paradox in the genealogy search, I think, that also connects up spiritually. Cynthia Ozick, the great Jewish fiction and nonfiction writer, Cynthia once made a very interesting metaphor that when you take a ram's horn, a shofar, you take a ram's horn and you blow through the wide end, you get nothing.
Right.
But when you blow through the narrow end, you get this beautiful, rich sound that ironically, paradoxically, people think that if you're tracing your own family, that somehow you're taking the narrow route. Why just your own family, and why be so narrow about it? Paradoxically, you find out that by taking that narrow route, you really connect with everybody. It's a when you blow into the narrow end, that's when you make the music. It kind of reminds me of something that my father often used to remind me of, which is that when the play Fiddler on the Roof was produced, of course, Fiddler on the Roof was based on the Yiddish stories of the famous Yiddish writer Shalom Aleichem and Tevye's daughters. And the Fiddler on the Roof was produced all over the world. And there was a book that was written about the phenomenon of the play Fiddler on the Roof. And it told the story of how the play was written and all the different productions around the world. And one chapter was about Japan, that when the Tokyo Theater Group put on a Japanese production of Fiddler on the Roof, the critic wrote in the newspaper in Tokyo that he couldn't understand how Fiddler on the Roof could be as popular anywhere else as it is in Tokyo. It's such a typically Japanese story.
That's great.
If the authors of Fiddler on the Roof would have tried to write a play about everybody, they probably reached nobody. But by going the narrow way and writing about this traditional Jewish family in Eastern Europe and this incredible play, Fiddler on the Roof, it became a universal message. There's something universal about the narrowness of it. I'm sorry if you hear that clicking in the background. It's actually one of my birds. I breed birds, and my parrot is getting a little bit noisy. So, I'm sorry.
Does it talk?
No, this parrot does talk, in fact.
The
parrot's name is Shabbos, and he says good Shabbos.
Oh, really? Can we hear
problem
it?
Is he says it on Wednesday also, but...
well, it's Tuesday. Can we hear it?
Well, no. Right now I haven't covered, so I don't want to get it started.
Right.
But the point that I wanted to make again was that by going into one's family history and doing the research and hitting the books and talking to the people and putting the family trees together, something is happening to the individual under the surface, you know, in the person's soul, that's not, like you were saying before, not always so easy to put words to, but so many of us who have done it can't deny that it happened.
It is amazing. You know, I've been actually working with a couple of clients recently and helping them with their research, and one of them was a 9/11 responder, a police officer, and he got totally, you know, his health is failing a little bit, and he has some young sons, and he wanted to make sure that the family legacy was left to these boys, and he was stuck with his grandfather. He couldn't find him anywhere, didn't know where he was, I mean, nothing, and nothing passed, and he, you know, when we first talked, I mean, his only thing that he wanted was pictures, photographs. He wanted images. And, you know, interestingly enough, I don't know how we did it, but I guess we were supposed to. We do have pictures en route. We actually found something that took him back two or three generations, found a second cousin, and they happened to have his grandfather's billfold and family pictures that's en route. And I'm going to tell you, it's that kind of thing that has probably jarred me into genealogy for most of my life. You know, while I have done some research on my own family, not as much as I would like over the years, I get so torn with, you know, the reasons and why people want this information, and I just feel compelled to, you know, try to be helpful in that regard. And, you know, he called me, I guess, on Sunday, and to tell me, obviously, the good news. And, you know, to hear a man in tears like that because, you know, he finally was able, you know, he was getting something that was meaningful to him, he thought was going to be meaningful for his children, that he didn't think he would ever find. And I, that to me is about as spiritual as doing it for myself. So, yeah. There's something to be said for, why people want to get into it. I mean, some people get into it, I think, and I'm sure you've noticed this, Arthur, too. You know, some people get into it, you know, for themselves and to take their family back and to, you know, do the whole historical thing of the family. And other people have a particular need. There's something either in their life or missing in their life, or they don't want to be missing in their life, that really gets them started. And it's very interesting and very compelling in some cases why they do this. You know, in my history over the last few years and the contacts that I've made, you know, people come for one little piece of information and never turn into genealogists or really have no other interest in genealogy other than that one little piece of information. You know, while others are, you know, like myself, over the years got totally obsessed.
You know, one of the things that I've thought about so often is, apropos of what you're saying, is that I've given hundreds and hundreds of lectures since the 1970s on genealogy. Easily 750 to 1,000 lectures on genealogy over the years. When I think of how many I did each year, year after year after year after year, and can continue to do. And I'm under no illusion that my audiences are going to go out and do as much genealogical research as I did. In fact, they don't need to. But I'm under no illusion that people are going to get all obsessed with genealogy the way some of us do.
Right.
And some of us have. But I also know that, you know, the next time somebody dies in their family and the family gets together, the next time somebody's invited for Passover or Christmas or Easter or some birthday or some holiday, the next time you get together with the older relatives, you just might ask a couple of questions that you might not have asked had you not heard my lecture. You might just be a little bit more open to remembering a good family story that has an important lesson to teach, or you just might be a little bit more open to certain people in the family. So I would argue that even those who are not interested or don't think that they're interested, that really it gets into everybody on one level or another. By the way, another aspect of it that was occurring to me as we were talking,
yes,
that I think that those of us who do genealogy realize, is that sometimes you meet relatives who you never met before, and within moments you feel like you've known them forever.
Right.
That you never saw them, never heard of them. You get together with them, and you feel like somehow there was a connection from before both of your lives, and there's some kind of a family connection that's, again, not so tangible and not so easy to put into words, but those of us who have experienced can't deny it.
Yes, and you notice that with friendships too. I don't know,
yes,
about
really.
You.
Yeah, this might be probably not too many forums where I can talk about this, so I'm going to take advantage of it. That I had an experience in Poland during one of my genealogical ventures in a Jewish cemetery, where I had the sense that I was murdered as a child during the Holocaust.
Wow!
I got back to the States after that trip from Poland, and I actually spoke to my rabbi about it, and he put me in touch with somebody who had a connection to therapists who do past life regressions.
Yes.
And I got very involved with it. I was regressed 7 different
really?
Times. I also have went on to get training in it, so I was certified as a hypnotherapist, and I found that process was an extremely intriguing and powerful one. And it grew out of my real sense. It was as real to me as that I'm talking to you right now when I'm standing in that cemetery in Poland that day all by myself and having this vivid, vivid sense that I was murdered as a child.
It's my fourth show, and I can't remember now. I know we're 13, 14, 15, somewhere in there at this point. But my fourth show, I had a world-renowned healer that I met back in February on the show. In fact, I'm going to have her back in August, at the end of August. I did my first past life regression.
Uh-huh.
And it was so very interesting.
Yes.
So very interesting. I'd never done it before. But
well, I did it 7 times, and the man who did it with me was very talented. And I don't know whether it's real or not real, but I experienced it as real as anything that I've ever done in my life.
I can second that. there was a healing that went on within me within minutes. I mean, right immediately after there was some issues, I guess, that I've been, I brought to this table from, a prior table, I guess.
That's right, exactly. I would agree that that's one of the things we learn about this whole past life regression work, which is that one of the things you end up doing is identifying patterns and repetitions that sooner or later you need to resolve, so you might as well get more focused on it and resolve it now. There's a lot of very interesting healing that can be done with past life regression and with hypnosis in general. Like I said, I got kind of involved with it. And
I had no idea. I'm glad to know that. I mean, I think people have thought I've lost my marbles here. So
maybe we both have, but
but
I don't think so.
No, I don't either. I've pretty much, I've been slowly, as I told somebody the other day, I said, I think I'm slowly starting to come out of this closet here.
To make a full circle.
Feel and how I really believe, I definitely believe in more things than a lot of people do.
Well,
and
you know,
I see it happen to me every day.
Yes, that's right.
I mean, and I think too that the more open you are to the spirituality and learning about your soul and understanding who you are. And, you know, the more you get bombarded with, it's amazing. It's truly amazing. I mean, I saw an immediate shift after that past life regression 6 weeks ago than I've seen in years. I mean, it was just almost an instant shift in perception.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a nice way to put it. I was just about to say that, taking it full circle back to Kabbalah, one of the teachings in Kabbalah is that people sometimes think that you're just a body, that you're born, you live, you die.
Right.
Some people believe that you're a body that has a soul, that you're not just a body, you're a body that has a soul. Kabbalah doesn't teach either of those two ideas. Kabbalah does not teach that you're a body, and Kabbalah does not teach that you're a body that has a soul. Kabbalah teaches that you're a soul that has a body.
Exactly.
That your soul existed before this particular body. Your soul picks up this body and uses it as an instrument. At a certain point, the soul drops this body and goes on with its work. And this
right.
is a central teaching of Kabbalah, which is coupled with, again, and it's in all of the Kabbalistic sources, that when the soul has a task in life, and you have to find out what your task is, even if somebody else can do it better than you, you're the one to find your task and to do it. And if you don't do your task, or if you damage something in the process, the soul is reincarnated in the body of another person, and again has to try to do its assignment.
Right, this is so similar to everything that's being, you know, discussed and taught at the quote generic spiritual level that I've been probably studying over the last few years. You know, I find too that people who kind of go or get guided in this direction usually do so from some sort of traumatic experience. I actually had my own near-death experience about 2.5 years ago. And, you know, when things like that happen to you, you begin to ask questions. And you ask different questions than you asked of yourself before. And you
come to the unbelievable conclusion that what you thought might have been a terrible situation ended up being a gift.
And not only that, that
one of the reasons
perhaps
why
you were being guided to do something else and not what it was you were doing.
One of the reasons why Kabbalah has always been considered a secret is not because we know something you don't know, but rather that some of these spiritual ideas are very subtle and very sensitive and have to be talked about carefully. I wear a ring. The ring that I wear has an Aramaic expression on it that goes back to Talmudic times. The ring in Aramaic, it says Gamzu L'tova. And Gamzu L'tova means this too is for the best.
Right.
That the Kabbalistic sages are teaching us to try to cultivate within ourselves the idea that everything happens for the best. It might not seem like it's for the best, but in some inexplicable way, everything is for the best. Now, to say this is an audacious statement to make. You know, innocent children, the Holocaust, how could you possibly say that everything is for the best? But those
right.
of us who have explored some of these ideas come away with a very subtle, very private feeling about what it is that's happening in the world, and it's not as we thought it might be.
I understand. I understand. I had a question for you, and I think I got so wrapped up in what you were talking about that I actually did forget it, which I tend to do these days. Things fleet in and things fleet out. I'm going to take just a moment of silence here and see if I can bring it back. I was talking about the the traumatic experiences.
You're talking about the near-death experience that you had, that's right.
Yes, yes.
And that sometimes you have to look carefully and see what it is.
And see, and ask, and not only ask why, but really say, what is my meaning in life? Right. I mean, you know, I always, there were times where I thought I was doing what I was supposed to be doing, and I kind of, realized maybe I wasn't, or maybe it was time for me to do something a little different, which is obviously what I'm doing, no question. And hoping, I guess, that maybe more and more people, Arthur, will begin to see things the way you and I do. And maybe they do. I posted, I did an intensive workshop back in February with spiritual intuitive, more or less, and she's absolutely phenomenal, funny, and, unbelievable at what she does. And she had posted on Facebook a couple of videos of one of her sessions that she had done in Lowell, Massachusetts that were absolutely hilarious. I thought they were funny. So I decided to post it on my Facebook page because they were funny. And it was very interesting, some of the responses I got back. I think one person mentioned they were embarrassed that they had been to a Kabbalist and had their palms read. And, and I'm thinking to myself, maybe there are more people. Maybe there are more people. This is where I was going. Who really are there, but are scared to admit it. And, maybe that's what we need in this time, day and age is, for everybody to recognize these things within themselves and to be able to be frank and upfront about it. I kind of go back there are two things. Number one, right after I started having genealogy, you'll love this, I started having panic attacks. And I think I've related that to this whole shift because they could never find anything wrong with me. I mean, they would just happened. But, at the same time, when I started into this, I recognized a whole shift within myself from that time forward. And I can now go back and block that as a major turning point in my life as far as, who I was and where I went and what I did. It was an incredible, incredible shift. And I just find those things very interesting because, I wonder. I mean, have you ever gotten involved in any of that? I guess disease or dis-ease or whatever that comes about from just harboring things that you don't let go of, I guess.
No, without a doubt. But I guess I'm free associating to Kabbalistic teachings again that one of the profound teachings that we receive is that every descent is for the sake of ascension. That there's no such thing as down.
Right.
That when you fall, you think that it's a fall, but it's really not. It's really a preparation for the next ascent, the next climb that you could never have done. Anybody's ever gone to an amusement park knows that when you're on the roller coaster, the only way you get way up there is if you go down and then you come back up. And
right.
The Kabbalists teach that every descent is for the sake of ascension. So that we use these stumbling blocks and we use these trials and we use these challenges and questions and traumatic experiences as gifts. That help us to open to the truth of things.
And going back there, you know, after I started having those panic attacks and I started talking and being open about it, you wouldn't believe how many people had panic attacks. Yeah. I think the whole world has had panic attacks at one point in their lives or another. I've met more people that have had them than have not. But it wasn't until I brought it up and I said something about it to someone that they said, oh, I've had those too. And then all of a sudden, you know, people start talking about it and you start seeing it on the news and whatever. So, you know, maybe these are some things that, do need to be verbalized and people need to, you know, begin to, you know, not be afraid to admit some of these things.
Yes.
Do you believe our time is up? It's hard for me to believe.
It's been great speaking with you. Thank you so much for the opportunity to have this conversation.
Well, Arthur, I have enjoyed it immensely. I'm just I'm glad to have someone who I you know share some of the same ideas and thoughts and feelings and with and you know in particular someone within my own faith. So
thank you. I hope that that those people who are listening also are aware of the extraordinary contributions that you have made to the field of genealogy. I'm happy to have an opportunity to speak to you and to tell you thank you on behalf of tens of thousands of people, which obviously is no exaggeration, probably hundreds of thousands, if not that, and more than that, who have benefited from your insights and your vision and the hard work that you've done over the years. So, bravo.
Well, Arthur, thank you, and I tell you what, it's been fun to follow in your footsteps, too. That is for sure. This has been Where Genealogy and Spirit Connect. What a wonderful hour we have had. We will be back again next week. We have a very exciting guest in the field of genealogy, and that is Justin Trump with Ancestry.com. We have talked to Ancestry.com, which we just have. We'll start to talk with Ancestry.com has available to the genealogy world, so to speak. And in so being, King.